My name is Nick Georges. In 2019, I was trained and sent out to Palestine for 3 months as a humanitarian witness and a protective presence for the Palestinians. And for 3 months on a daily basis, I witnessed the atrocities and horrors of the illegal Israeli occupation of the Palestinians' homeland. So what I'm going to do today, I'm going to tell you two stories about two men who are friends of mine. One was not such a very strong friend. The other was a very good friend. So the first story.
Before you do that, can I just ask you, you know, because there's a lot of accusations that people like you, a bit like maybe CND back in the 1980s, are kind of useful idiots for the bad guys, because many people around the world think that the Palestinians are effectively terrorists trying to destroy the Israeli state.
Right, yes. Well, I think the thing is that Israel has control of the media, and it uses that to further its own propaganda for its own ends. So all we ever hear about is the Israeli propaganda. We never hear the Palestinian side of it, because they don't have any power in that department.
Well, hang on, though, because the Palestinians have been firing rockets at Israel too, haven't they?
Yes, the Palestinians have been firing rockets, but the UN states, this is the Palestinians, have been responding from their own land. And every country, every state has a right to try and protect itself. And the UN clearly states that every country that's occupied has a right to protect itself. So, yes, I'm not advocating violence in any shape or form. But I think that people do need to know that Hamas was democratically elected under very strict EU supervision. Hamas is the elected representative of the people of Gaza, and it's not a terrorist organization. It was democratically elected. As soon as it was democratically elected, both England and America instantly denied that and gave it no credit whatsoever. And it is, you know, I think if England had been invaded, I mean, for example, when Germany invaded France in the Second World War, and the French resistance fought back against the occupation, the German occupation, they weren't labelled as terrorists at all. They were labelled as heroes. You know, the Palestinians are fighting for their own land, their own peace, their own justice, their own security. And Israel has occupied them. So I think it's very hard to criticise the Palestinians for trying to, you know, fight for themselves.
Yeah, but I mean, the Israelis will say that God gave them that land, Nick.
Well, yes, you know, but the another way of looking at that is that the Old Testament and the Bible is not an estate agent's book. You can't just go quoting stuff from thousands of years ago. You know, that's not how modern territories and modern lands are worked out these days. You have to have a more sensible, fair way of it. You know, Palestinians lived there for thousands of years. Israel's wanted a Zionist movement, decided it wanted Palestine for its own land. You know, and so the Zionists just swept in with their terror groups in 1948. They destroyed over 500 Palestinian villages, and those people they didn't kill, but fled. I think 750,000 Palestinians fled Palestine to become refugees throughout Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, Iraq, Egypt, Morocco, all over the world. So the state of play is now that there are now 6.5 million Palestinian refugees worldwide. I mean, can you imagine the terror, the violence and the brutality to create a problem where you've got 6.5 million people scattered throughout the world who have been made homeless?
No, that is pretty amazing. And we here in Britain do bear a big responsibility for what's happened in Israel. Some have called it a kind of second crusade, you know, like in the medieval crusades, the Knights Templar trying to take over Jerusalem. Now it's happened all over again, you know, from the time of the Second World War. But what's Britain's role in all this been? I think, didn't it start with the Balfour Declaration?
Yes, it started with the Balfour Declaration in 1917, when Balfour said Britain would look favourably upon giving Palestine to the Zionist movement. You know, but the only trouble was that Britain's colonial power, you can't just give other people's homelands away to other people because it suits you politically. I think at the time, from what I can understand, England was losing the First World War. They desperately needed America to come in on our behalf and support us. And Rothschild said that if Britain would favourably give us Palestine, they would bear influence to bear in America to ensure that they did come in the First World War on our behalf. Which
well, that's happened. Right. I think it was Walter Rothschild, wasn't it? Was involved in the preparation of the Balfour Declaration. But look, let's come up to today. And I know you've been over to Palestine. You yourself have actually made friends with some people over there. And you've got, hopefully, if I'm right, some stories to tell about how they're getting on.
Yes, I've got two particular stories to tell. The first story is about my friend Haroon. And when I was over there, we had to do something called protective presence, which meant that when the Palestinians were out in their field harvesting their crops or looking after their sheep and their goat herds, they very often got attacked by the illegal Israeli settlers. And what we would do, we would go, as internationals, we would go in the fields with them and just sit with them or work with them when they were harvesting and be a protective presence there in the hope that our European presence would slightly ameliorate the behaviour of the settlers when they came down to attack them. So anyway, there's one little village. It was just in the hills above Atuani, a tiny little village. And a lot of their homes have been demolished. So half the village actually lived in caves. The villagers lived in caves, a very poor village. Anyway, they were out there doing the harvesting. It's very hot summer's day. And they looked after us very well. And I remember in particular this chap, Haroon, would always come and bring us coffee and drinks and cakes and things when we were out there. And he looked after us really well. And he was a very nice, very friendly chap. And then, unfortunately, what happened about a year ago, I mean, it was 2019, so I'm going back about 3 years when I was out there, and I met Haroon. In the same village, the Israeli army invaded the village, as they often do, and they went into a house there, kicked the occupants out, and they found a generator, a small petrol generator in the house. Now, the Palestinians are not allowed electricity. And the Israeli army will come along. If they've got any solar panels, they'll rip them and take them away. And they started to take this tiny little generator away. Haroon was the next door neighbor. He lived next door. He saw the army doing this and he rushed over and tried to stop them taking this generator away. And it ended up a violent tussle. He was tugging the generator one way. They were tugging it the other way. And this is one man against, I think it's 10 or maybe 12 soldiers. And there's a video that actually shows this. And, you know, all of a sudden the commander gets fed up with this, tells one of his men to step back. One of his men steps back and just shoots Haroon through the neck. So anyway, eventually at this stage, the army, they did actually abandon the generator and they left. So the Palestinians are rushed up. They've managed to get a car. They've put Haroon in a car to rush him to hospital. But the Israeli soldiers then decide this, they don't want this to happen. So they then shoot out the tires on this car, completely disabling it. So they can't get him to hospital. So Haroon is then lifted out of the car. He's carried probably about 2 miles, I think, down to the village of Atuani, where they find another car. So he's loaded in a second car, rushed to hospital. But then what the Israeli army does, they put a roadblock. So the car can't get to hospital. Fortunately, they've got a good driver in the car and he goes miles off road all round across the rocks and the boulders and the desert. And finally, they do get Haroon to hospital. It's very touch or go whether he's going to live. They don't know. Anyway, they do everything they can and they manage to just about keep him alive. But the trouble is the Palestinian hospitals are very, very poorly set up. They don't have the equipment, the finance, the money that obviously the top Israeli hospitals have. So then started, I think it was something like a 2-month battle between the Palestinian Authority and the Israelis to try and get Haroon taken into an Israeli hospital where it's the only place he's going to get the care to try and save his life. And eventually, various charities raised huge amounts of money. And eventually, he was taken to an Israeli hospital. Further operations were done. And his life was saved. He's completely disabled from the neck downwards. At one stage, once he became aware, he tried to, I think by moving his neck or his head, he tried to rip all the life support systems out of his body, tried to commit suicide. But anyway, they prevented that happening. So what has now happened, he's out of hospital, and they've made a special home for him in Yatta. He has literally got to have full-time care because he's paralyzed from the neck down. And that's his life now. And that's what's happened to him because he tried to stop the army taking a little generator out of his friend's house. The second story is about a village called Umm El Hair and a lovely man called Haj Suleiman. He's called Haj Suleiman because he was one of the people who's actually been on the Hajj to Mecca. And his family, the Hathlin family, had been Bedouin and they'd been farming sheep and goats in that area for years. They're a very well-known family, had huge flocks of sheep and goats. And then what happened, settlements came, moved in right next door to the village of Umm El Hair and destroyed all their land, took all their land, took most of their sheep and goats. And so he was left with a very much, much smaller amount of land and a very much smaller herd of sheep and goats. But he was a real fighter. And you would always see Suleiman in his beautiful white clothes, his white garb, his white galabeer around his head and his stick, because he was nearly 85. And every time the army came to do a demolition or something, wherever it was in that area, Suleiman would always be there. He would always be at the forefront. He'd always have 4 or 5 soldiers on him, around him, surrounding him, blocking him, stopping him. And he would take up literally half the army every demolition. He was an absolute lion and a real icon. And I remember the Israeli army came in about 5 jeeps to Umm El Hair, this tiny village. And they got out, all the generals got out and Regevim, and they took loads of photos of the village and then disappeared again. This is always a precursor to a demolition. They take their photographs, they go back, they decide what houses are going to demolish, and then 2 or 3 days later, they come back with the army and the JCBs, and they demolish whatever they want to demolish. So anyway, we were told about this, and as internationals, we went there to try and, again, ameliorate any of the excessive violence that happens during a demolition. And we were there very early one, but we had to get in very early because what happens, the Israeli army block off all the roads to the villages they're going to demolish. So the internationals, the press and the photographers can't get there. So I think we were there at 4 o'clock in the morning. And gradually this dawn came up. It was a beautiful morning, beautiful sunrise. And I was wandering around the village and I thought, right, I'm going to take a load of photographs of the village before it gets demolished. I didn't know what was going to be demolished. So I was there taking photographs of all the buildings, the cooler buildings are mainly tents, basically. And Suleiman was there. And Suleiman, I got to know him already. We were good friends already. We'd had wonderful talks. And instantly saw me, you know, rushed over. And he literally got 2 twigs. And within 5 minutes, had a little fire going, boiled up the kettle. And we sat there having our coffee together and discussing the moon. And I remember him teaching me the Arabic for the moon and the lovely sky. And I took loads of videos of him and his wife watering and feeding their flock of sheep and goats ready for the day. I took lovely videos of it all. And of him, and then he came up and he made tea and coffee for all the internationals who were there, you know, being protective presidents. And it was just very, very good memories of him. And again, this was in 2019, three years ago now. Anyway, obviously, Suleiman has gone on being the lion and he's always at the forefront of our circles. And wonderful videos of him fighting off the army single-handed. And he's carried on in this role as being their sort of icon of resistance. And I think it must have been about 2 months ago, he went off to try and stop a demolition, and they tried to run him over. But luckily, the Palestinians managed to get in the way and save him. But this is what they do now. The army tries to run people over. It's a different way of killing them. But anyway, what happened about a month ago, Suleiman saw the army coming to do demolitions. He went down to meet them, despite all his friends telling him not to. And this time the army was coming to tow away Palestinians' own cars. So what they do, they got a big tow truck, which is part of their army regime. They smash the windows on the car, let the handbrake off, and just take the Palestinians' vehicles. And the army's there to make sure no one does it. So anyway, Suleiman's gone down to stop this. And this tow truck driver has driven his truck straight at Suleiman. Suleiman's jumped off the road, and this truck followed him off-road and smashed him over, dragged him underneath the truck for about 30 yards. The driver, and I think this is all on video, then got out and said, right, that's a good job done. Anyway, the army then just disappeared and left Suleiman lying there. So obviously the Palestinians gone out, picked him up, roughed him off the hospital, incredibly badly wounded. They managed, again, the Palestinian hospitals don't have the skills. The Israelis refused to give him a permit to travel, so they banned him from being taken anywhere, so he was never going to get to any of the Israeli hospitals. He's put on life support and put in an induced coma, and I actually saw the hospital report on his injuries, absolutely horrific injuries. Anyway, they didn't turn the life support machine off, but 2 days ago, Suleiman died of his injuries. So there you just have a story of two friends I met when I was out there 3 years ago, and this is what happens to the Palestinians. And this is just a typical example, I'm afraid, of the results of Israel's ethnic cleansing to further their apartheid policies of a Palestine for Jews only. And they just how they go about the daily business of genociding the Palestinians, which is just absolutely awful.
Well, I wonder, look, with all your experience and your knowledge of what's going on out there, and I would totally agree with you, I think that the press do not cover this in a balanced fashion at all anymore. I think that there is really no chance to get a view of the horrific day-to-day harassment that there is of Palestinians, the impoverishment, the genocide. I think this word apartheid gets thrown around, but even Bishop Desmond Tutu, who died over the Christmas period, he was very clear that what's happening to the Palestinians is apartheid, and he was saying also that it's worse than what was happening in South Africa to the black people, the indigenous people in South Africa, from the white supremacists and the colonialists, because even though the Mandela and his friends were not being bombed from the air, now actually they are, the Palestinians are, so it's far worse in and that's not me, that's Bishop Desmond Tutu saying that. So are you any thoughts about about that, and also potentially about solutions?
Well, Mandela, with Chief Mandela, who was actually Nelson Mandela's grandson, was very involved in Palestine, and obviously he's lived through the apartheid regime in South Africa, and he says himself that it is much worse than the apartheid in South Africa. As regards the bombings, for example, in May, Israel bombed Gaza, and I mean, Gaza's a completely defenseless city. They got no air defenses or anything whatsoever. So they just sent their drones, their bombs, their rockets in, and they just killed 319 people. This was just in May recently. 79 children died, 69 women died, and these are innocent civilians, completely unprotected. And yet, it barely got a mention in the English press. And this is how it goes. As regards solutions, it's not my place to say. I haven't got a clue what the best solution was. I think it's that they should leave Palestine back to the Palestinians' homeland. It's their own land. And they should leave it and let the Palestinians live there in peace on their own.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just looking at the British political scene and also reading Alan Duncan's diaries, which came out recently, as well as looking at the, amazingly, no British media has done it, but it took Al Jazeera to do an investigative documentary in London called The Lobby, which explained how big wads of cash were available for political individuals in the Labour Party, the Conservative Party, to particularly the Labour Party, which was being targeted under the Corbyn era, in order to support the Israeli cause within the Labour Party. And in fact, the money for that comes from the United States. It's an enormous amount of money every year goes over to Israel, and then it comes back to London, and it comes back into brown envelopes for Labour Party MPs, including Joan Ryan, to go into her pocket in order to for her to lobby for the Israeli government and the Israeli state. We've also got Priti Patel, who's now Home Secretary in the Conservative Party, who had something like 15 secret meetings. So there's also with the Israelis when she was supposed to be on a family holiday, even though she was International Development Secretary. So that was what she was initially sacked for. She's now back in a much more powerful position, even being talked about as a potential successor to Boris Johnson, even though the odds are you know, against her. And somebody like Liz Truss or Rishi Sunak is more in the... Anyway, well, I suppose what I'm trying to say here is that this money, which is used to bribe Conservative Party, Labour Party MPs and officials in London by the Israeli embassy and their political attaché there, who was Shai Massot when that was that documentary was shot by, I repeat, Al Jazeera, not by the BBC, not by ITV, not by Channel 4 News or Dispatches or even Sky News, but or even GB News, but by Al Jazeera over in Qatar in the Middle East. It took them to do this film. So this is really the money that's coming from the United States all the time to keep Israel propped up is then being used to bribe politicians to support Israel, potentially also in any future war. So surely that actually might make a difference if the Americans stopped giving all this billions every year to the Israelis, the billions of dollars.
Well, yes, obviously it would make a huge difference. Going back to what you were saying, I mean, like, for example, Jeremy Corbyn was pro-Palestinian and Israel could not tolerate the idea. And he was very successful. He was very successful. I think thousands more people joined the Labour Party as a direct result of Corbyn's policies, his social care policies. But Israel could. So they waged a never-ending, relentless four-year campaign and accusations against anti-Semitism against Corbyn. For 4 years, this relentless campaign went on, waged by the whole of the media, which is obviously controlled, and they destroyed Corbyn. Corbyn, of all the ministers in government, Conservative or Labour, was the least anti-Semitic of all of them. He would have done more to support the Jews than any of the other parties put together. And yet, because he supported Palestine, he was destroyed. And I think it's shameless that a foreign country can influence the politics and bring down one of our two. We've only got two political parties in this country, basic, Conservative and Labour. And Israelis can, with their funds and influence, bring down one of our leading democratic leaders. I think it's horrendous that our democracy is affected by this. And yes, there's a huge problem. America gives Israel $3.9 billion every year purely for military and propaganda purposes. And this has enabled Israel to become one of the world's biggest providers of military hardware to countries. Israel's military trade and their armaments businesses, they sell weapons to 118 countries worldwide. And this is where all their income comes from. This is hugely important. This is their biggest source of income, is their income from selling military weapons to all these countries all over the world. And the biggest advantage they have in selling these weapons is that they advertise and they market them as being battle tested on the Palestinians. So although Israel complains bitterly and makes huge political propaganda out of Hamas, is Hamas actually serves them very well. I mean, Israel being the fourth largest military and nuclear power in the world could wipe Hamas off the map in 5 seconds flat if it wanted to, but it doesn't want to. It suits its marketing purpose to market all their weapons worldwide as battle-tested on Hamas and on the Palestinians. So this serves them a very useful purpose.
Yeah, $3 billion at least a year going there. And the total,
and that's just
enormous.
What we hear about.
Yeah, so and I would also point out there is a extremely good, I mean, it's very, very difficult to get this coverage in the national press here. It does happen occasionally, but it really is, you know, they have these thing that the Israelis horrifically call mowing the lawn, which is the regular killing of Palestinians just to keep the population, the numbers down. You know, obviously that is genocide. I mean, anyone can see that quite obviously. But there is a website called ifamericansknew.org. Just one long string of three words, ifamericansknew.org.
Yes, by Alison Weir.
Which I think is a very, very good basic source of knowledge. But then there are things like the Middle East Eye as well, which is a much more balanced view, including recently, by the way, an article about the Tony Blair George Bush memo, which has finally managed to make its way out, where we can see that there was a deliberate plot by these two war criminals who have basically been in Malaysia. They have been found to be war criminals, George Bush and Tony Blair. And this illegal war that was done in 2003. So anyway, look, I just wonder, I'd like to finish, Nick, with just giving you the opportunity to point out one or two websites of your own where you think people can go and actually get some proper news. Because at the moment, I'm afraid the only place, you know, no one is going to tell us stuff about what's going on in the world, whether it's to do with COVID at home or foreign policy in the Middle East. Yeah. So can you point us to it? I've mentioned ifamericansknew.org. And Middle East Eye. What about you?
It's very difficult to get regular, honest news. I mean, I'll just give you one little brief example, if I may. In June this year, I climbed to the top of a 380-foot tower crane right next door to the American Embassy. I stayed up there 2 days and a night. I slept up at the top of the jib of this crane, 380-foot up in the air, and I flew a huge Palestinian flag from the top of the crane. The police shut down the whole area. They shut down the underground. They put complete media blackout on it. It got a lot of publicity. And what happened, it got in Russia Today. It got on Press TV. It got on Middle East Eye. It got on Middle East Monitor. It got in Al Jazeera. It was publicized worldwide, but not one word was mentioned on the British press about it. So this is just an example of the bias and who controls the press in our country.
Hang on a minute, because I know I don't want to undermine your point, but the Daily Mail did report it, didn't they? Maybe they were the only one.
I think that was the only one that did. And it was quite interesting, the letters they got saying if he's come from a foreign country, then he should have fallen off and he should have got killed and he should have been sent back. And there's quite a lot of negative content from their readers, I'm afraid. But it wasn't reported in any of the other newspapers. It wasn't on any of the TV stations or reported anywhere else. There was a report on it. Yes, you're right. It was the Mail, I think. But other than that, nobody else touched it. So getting back to your point about where do you get reliable news? This is extremely difficult. Occasionally, The Guardian might put out a rather watered-down version. But basically, news-wise, you won't get any in this country. One of the places is Twitter. There's a wonderful lady called Sarah Wilkinson, who's got lots of contacts on the ground in Israel. And the information gets back to her. She's one of the first people in this country who knows what's actually going on the ground the minute it happens. So if you can follow Sarah Wilkinson on Twitter, then that's a very good way of finding out what is actually going on here and now. Other than that, Alison's Weir, If Americans Knew, is a very good organisation to get information from. And other than that, it's really difficult. There are so many organisations and groups and small bodies who do all advocate for Palestine. But to get good, honest, regular, reliable news is very hard.
I think we've just got to bookmark these things and check back there from time to time, haven't we? So the MiddleEastMonitor.com, that's just one word, MiddleEastMonitor.com. And then there's Al Jazeera. I suppose it's just the most accessible. Al Jazeera English is there, available on Freeview and on all your various satellite and cable channels too. Anyway, Nick Georges, thanks very much for joining us again.
Well, thank you very much for helping us all make us aware of what is going on in Israel and Palestine. That's really good, Tony. Thank you very much.
Yeah, and I think for me, the interesting thing here is that, you know, is the bigger picture. What is this really all about? Because I'm very concerned that amongst all the other things that have been going on in the world over the last couple of years, that there is most definitely still an effort to get a war going between Israel and Iran, which could be absolutely catastrophic, dragging in the superpowers. So, I mean, do you think that is feasible as well, Nick?
Well, I think, I mean, unfortunately, I have got very involved in, I don't know, probably a lot of people aren't aware, but there's an Israeli armaments company called Elbit. They've got 10 factories. This Israeli armaments there's 10 Israeli armaments factories making 85% of the weapons for the Israeli army in England. And I've got involved quite heavily with this, with trying to shut these factories down. And I found out an awful lot about the armaments trade and Elbit's trade worldwide. And it is quite shocking. My main concern is Palestine, but having found out so much about Elbit and the arms trade, I've realised now Palestine is just the tip of the iceberg. And you're quite right. Israel is determined to go to war with Iran. It's assassinated its nuclear scientists. It's assassinated its generals. It's desperate to go to war with Iran. And some of the covert stuff that it's done to Iran already, it's amazing that Iran has not retaliated. I think they've been incredibly wise, incredibly shrewd and sensible, but must be very difficult when Israel is doing all this stuff in the background all the time. I mean, like, for example, last year alone, Israel did over 500 bombing raids in Syria. No one ever hears about that, do they? Mm-hmm. And their whole aim is to cause chaos all around them. And you look at the chaos now, the instability that's been created around Israel. Now, you just start from left to right. They've completely destabilized Lebanon. Syria is totally destabilized. Iraq is totally destabilized. Most of this has come as a result of 9/11. And that gave them, in effect, the authority to start all these wars and to create all this destabilization. And yes, Israel loves to have a threat. It loves to have this threat and their big threat, their big fear that they stoke all their threats of their own security upon. Is this all aimed at Iran now? And they would love to go to war with Iran, have a nuclear war with Iran. Hopefully they won't. But I think, as Julian Assange said, he said, it's not Russia and China we need to be aware of. It's Israel that's going to start the next world war.
Okay, Nick Georges, thanks very much for joining us.
You're welcome. Cheers, Tony.